Maybe we could look at a subject that is a very important subject in terms of one's development of consciousness. You know that you can start many ways, but here's one fascinating way to begin the subject, and that is that the Gemara says in one place that what attracts one to do something that's wrong, the Gemara describes in a paradoxical fashion, or rather, the verse in Isaiah, actually in the fifth chapter of Isaiah, describes a paradoxical attraction to sin. Thank you very much. Don't mind if I just put on a... Stop the bleeding.
Do you need a doctor?
Yeah, no, stay away from me. Stay away from me. Thank you. Do everything just away. Stay away from those guys. Okay, and here's what it says. The verse says that a person is attracted to do what's wrong by spider's threads, or by threads that are no thicker than a spider's thread. And the verse ends by saying that, in fact, one is attracted by thick cables or ropes that are used to pull a cart. So the verse in Isaiah begins by talking about people attached to sin by a very fine thread, and ends by talking about people attracted to do what is wrong with very thick cables. And the Gemara says, the Gemara's interpretation or explanation of that verse is that when one is initially tempted to sin, when one is initially tempted to do something that's wrong, the temptation is incredibly weak. The description is like the word in the pasuk is chevle ashav. Chevle ashav means threads of nothingness, and the Gemara describes them as spider threads. And then the verse ends by moshchei avon, which means the cables that attach you. And there the Gemara says they're like the cables they used to use to draw carts, you know, like the today I suppose you call them steel cables or the ship's cables, very thick cables. What does this mean? Is that true in our experience? In other words, when one is attracted to do something wrong initially, we're being told that there's no real attraction. No real attraction. When you sin initially, when you go wrong initially, there's really no attraction to the sin. Once you've gotten into it, once you've done it once or twice or a few times, then there's a very strong, perhaps in English you might even call it addiction. What does that mean? What's being said here? So let's think this through. In fact, if you examine your own experience, I think you see this. You know that when a person is initially faced with something that he's never tasted, something that's illicit, improper, sinful, that you've never tasted, there really is no attraction to it. After one's done it a few times, it becomes almost impossible to resist. But second example, it's a 13-year-old young man who contemplates smoking his first cigarette. Right? There's no attraction. There's no innate attraction. The addictive force, right? The compulsion is not felt initially. We have to understand what exactly the attraction is. But initially, when he contemplates doing that thing, there can't be an innate attraction. He's never tasted it before. There can be no inner drive. And what happens is he tries his first cigarette and it doesn't taste good at all. Not at all. Right? First time, in fact, some parents have a policy that they want to make sure their children don't smoke, is they make sure they smoke one cigarette completely. Right, in front of him, completely, without a pause, from beginning to end. Right, because they know the child will feel so sick. Hopefully, he'll never touch it again, and that's what happens. So the first time he indulges in this illicit activity, in fact, it doesn't taste good. That isn't necessarily always true, but in this case, it certainly is. And somehow, despite it making him feel sick, somehow he gets through that, and eventually, somewhere down the line, it becomes an addiction. A very powerful addiction, even to a point where the person is ill and knows that it's tremendously harmful, and yet somehow it overcomes him. I mean, I always share my own personal experience in this, because I was very impressed by this experience that I saw when I was starting out as a young doctor. I was doing surgery at the time. I was a junior intern in surgery, and we got in our hospital ward a patient who had Berger's disease. This disease is a genetic susceptibility to the nicotine in cigarette smoke. People who have this disease, if they smoke, their blood vessels close down, right? First their fingers fall off, then their hands fall off. Okay, their body gradually falls apart, literally, right? They're left without fingers, without... The reason is that the blood vessels are clamping down in excessive response to the nicotine, which is a vasoconstrictor. And there's not one recorded case in a non-smoker, right? It's a genetic susceptibility there. If they smoke, they have this exaggerated response, and that is what the disease does. If they stop smoking, the disease arrests at that point. If they carry on smoking, their body literally, right, this is what happens. And on this occasion, I was a junior intern. It was my first year in surgery, and we got this 45-year-old, highly intelligent engineer who came into our ward with a blue leg. The reason is that the main artery supplying his leg had been closing down, and his leg had been going blue. His toes were already black, and they were gangrenous. And the man knew that if he carried on smoking, we'd have to cut his leg off. He carried on smoking, and we had to do an above-knee amputation. Okay. The next time I saw him, I was a senior intern, and I noticed him being wheeled down the hospital corridor in a wheelchair with no legs, smoking, on his way to losing an arm. Okay. Now, you have to understand that. I mean, that is, you see, he's an intelligent man, knows exactly what's going on. He knew more about the disease than we did, researched it fully, and he stands there with a cigarette and a leg, and the choice is very clear, right? The choice is either throw it away and live, which means live, leg, you know, man, husband, father, walk, leg, or 30 seconds of pleasure during which you'll feel, you know, the hand of death. What makes that possible? And you think, you know, you sort of snicker at that, but each of us is caught in our own version of that. May not be losing your, you know. I mentioned this to a group of doctors in America, and one of them told me he's got a friend who's a vascular surgeon who had a patient like this, that when he lost his second arm, he had his friends rig up a piece of wire on the wheelchair so he could carry on smoking. So what does this mean? How does a person get to that situation where they're prepared to contemplate losing their limbs because of the intense compulsion that they have? And that started as something that had no compulsion at all. It's not compulsion. When a 13-year-old takes his first cigarette, it's not compulsion. There's some attraction. We have to understand what that is. But that's a very peculiar thing. What is the attraction? But let's think through this. It's a very, 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 nothing could be more relevant to us, of course. What is that? What is that? And if you think it through, you'll realize that the initial attraction is not a compulsion. The initial attraction to something that later becomes a sensual attraction and a compulsion, the initial thing is only imagination. The initial attraction is only illusion. It's a fantasy. It's the fantasy of the image or fantasy of the pleasure. And of course, the world of advertising knows that very well. Right? So the world of advertising links very deep aspects of character and personality and aspiration to an image. But in the beginning, it's only a fantasy. That child is contemplating that cigarette. The attraction there is only the world of fantasy. It can only be in the world of fantasy because there's no innate attraction. Once it's been tasted, and that's what the Gemara is telling you, is that the verse in the Torah is telling you that the initial attraction is only a spider's thread. It'll be easily snapped. There's no problem snapping it then. After it's been indulged, and that thread thickens up, and it becomes a cable, then it could be as painful as life itself to detach from that thing, right? When there's that inner compulsion. You go back to the origin of this problem, right? The origin of this problem is the origin of the human problem. When man is created initially, Adam and Eve are created initially. So there was no attraction to sin. There was no innate attraction. There was no compulsion. The way the Torah describes it is the temptation was posited by an external being, right? Adam or Eve, or Adam and Eve, or both of them. They were faced by a serpent speaking from the outside, right? The serpent, there was no inner voice. There was no inner voice saying, you know, this will taste good and you can't survive without it. There was no compulsion. It was a completely dispassionate judgment. In fact, the way the Torah puts it is the woman saw that the fruit of the tree was good to eat. She saw. There was a fantasy, there was an illusion, there was an appearance. and something artificial and false was being built up. The voice that we feel today, the voice that attracts us to things that are illicit, the sensual attraction that we feel innately today, right? The problem is that we're already walking down that path where the spider's thread has become a strong cable. But that wasn't the original human situation. The original human situation was that there was only a question of judgment. And the serpent appeared at a distance, and the serpent said, "Would you like to taste the fruit of this tree?" And there was no... You know, it's very well known, this is not the time to go into it in detail, but it's very well known that what the serpent actually tempted her into was an intimate relationship, of course. In other words, to become one. Initially, the serpent was something outside of her, and was only a voice presenting a fantasy. But what she succumbed to, of course, was the seduction, which led to a relationship. And after that, there's a meshing of the voice of evil and the voice of temptation with one's own voice. Know that you could say this many ways. One way to put it is like this. The Rambam was once attacked by a thinker who challenged him as follows. Maimonides, he was once challenged with the following attack. That before man and woman, ate the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, so they had no knowledge of good and evil. They had no knowledge of good and evil. It's a tree of the knowledge of good and evil. When you eat the fruit of that tree, you gain the knowledge of good and evil. So this person said to the Rambam, there's something very strange here. Man exists in a state where he does not know good and evil, and God warns him not to eat the fruit of the tree. But if he eats the fruit of the tree, which in fact he does, he gains the knowledge of good and evil. How can a sin, which is so lethal and so dangerous and so damaging, that sin brought death to the world, and from then on it's been downhill. How could a sin, such a flagrant disobedience of what Hashem wants, something so negative, how could it lead to our gaining something? Before man is a creature, a being who does not know good and evil, and after he eats from the fruit of the tree, he's a creature who knows good and evil. So you see that he benefited from the sin. That was the claim. And this is the answer the Rambam gives. It's worth a lot of thought, this. It's very difficult for us, because for us to really understand this, we have to try to put our heads into that pre-sin state. Very hard for us. But of course, that's what we're striving for. So he answered like this. The fact that we now know good and evil is not an advantage, it's not a gain of function, it's a loss of function. The fact that we know good and evil, that we can feel good and evil, we can distinguish between good and evil, or we can't distinguish, the whole faculty of knowing good and evil is a step down for us. He explains like this. When Adam was created originally, he didn't know good and evil. He only knew true and false. The polarities that were available to him were true and false. There was no good and evil, which is a value judgment, a question of relative values. There was no relative values. There was true and false. The sin led true and false to become good and evil. Right? That's not a step up, that's a step down. Meaning that when Adam was tempted to sin initially, the temptation was... See, we have to, again, get out of our present mode. Our mode is, when there's a temptation to sin, the temptation is, taste this, it'll be delicious. So there's an inner attraction to that sin. But Adam wasn't given an option like that. The only option he was given was true or false. In other words, all he saw in the world was either true or false. And an option to sin, an option to do something illicit that would cause damage in the world and bring death to the world and all the consequences of sin, was an option to choose falsehood. Right? You have to understand, it's like when we're faced with good and evil today, the good option is good. The evil option is evil, but it will taste good. There'll be something good in it. Maybe it'll be worth it. We all go through that. Maybe it's worth it. It'll only last a few minutes more, but it'll be good. But that's not how his calculation... The calculus that he used was only true or false. The analogy would be, if I come to you and I say, you can do something good or something bad, and I try to tempt you into the bad, and you consider it. You know you shouldn't. You have a sense of morality and refinement. On the other hand, it'll taste good. Maybe you won't be punished. Maybe you'll get away with it. But if I came to you and I said, look, you can either choose 1 and 1 is 2 or 1 and 1 is 3. And I'd like to sell you the idea that 1 and 1 is 3. When Adam was tempted with a sin, it was no different than the temptation to accept 1 and 1 equals 3. All he had was true and false. He didn't have an option for bad. bad, going against what Hashem wanted, was completely false. It meant...
So, being a, such an enlightened human being, how could this happen?
That's what I'm about to try to explain. He was given only his clarity of thought, admitted only things that were true and things that were false. There was no difference in his mind between trying to convince himself that 1 and 1 equals 3 and trying to convince himself that he ought to go against Hashem's command. What could be more ridiculous? Hashem is the definition of reality. He says, don't eat the fruit of this tree. And not only that, he tells you the consequence. You'll die on the day you eat the fruit of the tree. And you're now an eternal being. What possible attraction could that have? There was no innate attraction. The attraction was only a voice speaking from the outside. Says the Rambam, after he ate the fruit of the tree, he no longer lives. We no longer live in the dimension of true and false. Our dimension of true and false is only a very rarefied zone, you know, the mathematical and the logical, perhaps, and certain aspects of the logical and technical issues. But when it comes to the world of values, there's no true and false. It's good and bad. Every good has some potential bad in it. Every good has a price. And every bad has some potential redeeming. No matter how brutal and extreme, it's got some tasty element. In fact, the option that he chose to replace true and false with good and evil wasn't only an option that, you know, the good will sort of be very logical and the bad will be illogical. He chose an option where the thing becomes so confused that it's almost impossible to tell them apart.
But did he know that when he was choosing?
Yes, of course he did.
No.
You got the same problem as you did. How does that 13-year-old taste that first? Why does he take that first cigarette? What is it offering? He's got no sense of what it will be. And when he tries it, it's disgusting.
He may have a lot of sense of what it will be from hearsay. From you're taking a pure abstract example.
Absolutely.
Where he's completely...
Don't you remember?
He's never met anyone who smoked. He's never seen anybody smoke.
When you were 13, you hid behind a garage. And you had this big fat cigar,
picked,
right?
The wrong person, because never did that. But Adam, what she says, is so wise.
No. He was only wisdom. So slowly, one step at a time. But that's us, that Adam. That's us. That first time you taste that illicit thing, there's no inner drive to it. You can't have any. You've never tasted it and what it is. And when you taste it, it's disgusting. Disgusting. You're sick as a dog. And somehow he manages to do it again, and before he knows it, it's an addiction. What? Yeah?
But why create... in the first place, if you don't...
That's not our problem. That's not our problem now. I'm in enough trouble with these. What do you want? A world with no temptation? No possibility of going wrong? No free will? You want to just...
So then why not give it at the beginning?
This was the beginning. This is the first thing a human being ever did. What beginning? He was created and an hour later presented with the opportunity to sin. What do you mean at the beginning?
So why not create him with the knowledge of good and bad to start with?
Why create him disadvantaged? Hashem created him perfect, with no illicit component. He doesn't play unfair. Why not create every teenager with an innate addiction to the worst possible things? That's what you're asking. Create him as a drug fiend, and then ask him to climb out of it. Hashem doesn't do it that way. He created him clean, dry, perfect. And he presented him with a dispassionate, completely distant option. Speaking from the outside. And the voice of evil was as illogical as 1 and 1 is 3. That's all he asked him to overcome.
You couldn't have been perfect without such a choice.
Having free choice is your perfection.
Okay.
After he chose that option, the confusion between good and evil becomes insurmountable. You know that you could say it like this: before the sin, he was pure, his consciousness was only spiritual. That means the way he saw himself, the way he thought of himself, the way he grasped himself, was only a desire, a flaming desire to connect with Hashem and go back to his source, right? That's all he was. The first person I, the I, was only that spiritual being. The sensual and the illicit and the animal and the pulling away from the divine was a completely external thing. You know, you could say it like this. The easiest way to conceive it is that it was the opposite of the way we are now. The way a human being is now is that all your inner consciousness, all your awareness is all the sensual, it's all body. It's all the body. Now, you could put it like this. They say that the sources that talk about this say that when Adam was created, his body was completely transparent. The way the Talmud puts it is he was clothed in garments of light. His body was made out of light. What's called kosnos or. He was clothed in light. That's a way of saying that the neshama, the inner being, the inner light of the spirit, shone out through a transparent body. Light means a medium of revelation, right? After the sin, he became clothed in garments of skin. Or, you know that in Hebrew, you don't appreciate this in English. In Hebrew, he was first clothed in garments of aleph vav resh, or, which means light. After the sin, he became clothed in garments of ayin vav resh. You know, in Hebrew, when an aleph becomes an ayin, it represents a transition from the spiritual to the material. Right? Take words in Hebrew that are spelt with an aleph and spell them with an ayin. Right? Ayin, which means is not seen, becomes ayin, the organ that does see, that reveals. Make a list. Fascinating exercise. But initially he was clothed in garments of aleph vavresh, light. And after the sin he was clothed in garments of ayin vavresh, skin. Anyone who knows any Hebrew knows that aleph vavresh in Hebrew spells light, and ayin vavresh in Hebrew, which means skin, spells iver, blind. You cannot see. Aleph vavresh is the medium of revelation, that which enables you to see. Ayin vavresh means that which makes it impossible to see. In English, this is called a hide. Why in English is the skin called a hide? Where did they get that from? Because initially it was a reveal, it was or. After the sin, it becomes a hide. Iver, blind. That's what it means, a thick hide, right? Meaning that before the sin, you could see the inside from the outside, and of course that's why they wore no clothing. We've discussed this many times. They didn't need clothing, and the Torah says there was no shame. There couldn't be shame. The outside showed the inside. The only reason you feel shame when you're naked is because the outside doesn't reveal the inside. The reason we feel ashamed when we're naked is because we stand knowing we have an angelic inner being, and it's housed in a vehicle that looks like a horse. At best. Why are we ashamed without clothes? You think it's a sociological phenomenon? No sociological. In all cultures, at least some part of the body is covered. By the way, initially man covered only his immediate nakedness. And then Hashem taught him that he has to cover the nakedness in a way that reveals dignity. Right? Because the problem always has to become the solution. That's another whole discussion. But initially there was nakedness and no shame because the body was not visible. The body showed the neshama. When you looked at the human being, you saw, the Gemara said that after he sinned and died, the light that shone from his heels was greater than the sun. Then before the sin, he was incandescent with spirituality. If you look very hard, you could make out the wispy outlines of a body. Today, when you look at a human being, you can only see the body. If you look very hard, you can make out the faintest glow of a soul. Perhaps 1 second before death and 1 second after death, there's something that changes on the face. Our sources call it the ziva panim, the glow on the face. But it's very, very, very faint. Extremely faint. You can easily miss it. But it's like, before it was like looking at a 1,000-watt electric bulb. You could only see the light. If you look very carefully, you might see the glass. But after the sin, and you can feel it very easily, before the sin, he was all spirit. The voice of the illicit and the sensual and the vested interest and the me and the egotistical, right, was completely external. It was a serpent speaking at a distance saying, excuse me, would you like to sin? After the sin, our innate voice is all sensual. The eye is always the sensual. When you're facing something delicious that you'd like to taste, especially if you shouldn't, what inner voice speaks? I'd like to taste that. I'd like to taste that. I'd like to taste that. And the conscience? No, you shouldn't. It's always the second person. And it's very humiliating. And it's usually not an equal tone of voice either. It's, I'd like to taste that. And the conscience is, excuse me. There's no question that the first person is always the sensual, the fallen, the childish. That comes first. That's the me. You know how the Gemara puts this? The Gemara says that the fallen, the sensual, the sinful, the childish, the animal, has taken over. The way the Gemara puts it is like this, that vested interest, those ulterior motives, that animal and childish and self-destructive urge, it has seven names. The Gemara goes through, it has seven names. The seventh name of the Yetzer is called the Tzfoni. Tzfoni, it has many meanings. It means the northern one. But one of the meanings of the Tzfoni means the hidden one. Tzafun in Hebrew means hidden. Right? We hide the Afikoman, it's called Tzafun, right? We hide it, Tzafun. Tzfoni. The Yetzer is hidden. The obvious question is, Yetzer is hidden? I know my Yetzer very well. He is not hidden from me. I know him very well. He speaks to me the moment I open my eyes in the morning. The first thing he says, as soon as I open my eyes, he says, Tatsy, says, you know how cold it is out there? You know how tired you are? Usually the conversation lasts about 2 milliseconds, then I'm asleep again. But what do you mean the Yetzer is hidden? We know we have a Yetzer. No, he's hidden in the most dramatic and effective fashion. The most effective way to hide something is to put it right there in the public eye, where no one would ever think of looking for it. The way the Yetzer is hidden is, he's taken over. He's not ducking and dodging in the crevices of your inner awareness. He's taken over. He's saying I when he means you. You know, the Gemara puts it like this. This force of self-destruction, this lower being, the Talmud says, is first like a passerby in the street. Then he's like a beggar at the door. Then he's like a guest in your home. And then if you're lucky, you remain a guest. Meaning he's taken over. If you're lucky, the spiritual remains some sort of guest. My Rebbe once put it like this. He said, what's the right way to rob a bank? I mean, you have to imagine him saying this, but what's the right way to rob a bank? You walk in with a motorcycle helmet and a gun. Nobody in his right mind would do that. And the right way to rob a bank is to make an appointment with a manager, walk into his office, put a sock in his mouth, lock the door behind you, tie him up, put him in the cupboard, and sit at his desk and run the bank. That's the sensible way to rob a bank. Anybody with any brains, that's how you rob a bank. Okay? That's what's been done to us by the... What's running the show is not your mature, refined spiritual conscience. Who's running the show is your animal, childish, self-destructive. But he's saying, I. Talk about hidden. So when you say, I want this and I want that and me and I, you're talking about this completely undeveloped lower being. Where's the real I? He's buried in some going, occasionally, once a year. And therefore, beforehand, there was only true and false. The option of sin and self-destruction and bringing death to the world and going against reality. You're talking about Hashem's command. That's reality. Going against that was no more appealing than saying that 1 and 1 equals 3. And after the sin, it now becomes not a true and false option. It now becomes a good and a bad option. Let's understand this a little bit more deeply. What is the meaning of the eating of the tree, the fruit of the tree of good and evil? That's called Eitz Hadas Tovara, the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. What does that mean? Anyone who analyzes those words will be struck to note that it's not called the tree of evil. It's not called the tree of evil or the tree of the knowledge of evil. It's called the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. What's the good doing there? The whole point of that tree is its temptation. When you eat the fruit of that tree, evil enters the inner being. So why is it called the tree of the knowledge of good and evil? Now the secret is this. In Hebrew, the word dias, which is knowledge, always means intimate connection. Marital connection is called dias, knowledge. Knowledge means a bonding of the knower and the known. The tree of the knowledge of good and evil means the tree of intimate bonding of good and bad. It doesn't mean the tree of the knowledge of evil. It means the intimate bonding of good and evil where they can no longer be distinguished. When you eat the fruit of that tree, you don't become evil, you become confused. When you eat the fruit of that tree, you can no longer distinguish good from bad. Do you know what that tree is called in the Kabbalistic writings? It's called the Ilana de Sfeika, the tree of doubt. When you eat the fruit of that tree, what happens is a confusion. You can no longer sort out values in black and white terms. What happens to the... Man eats the fruit of the tree, and what happens? He starts hiding under the trees. Hiding from the one who sees through the trees. Talk about confused. That means, one moment he speaks to God and he knows exactly who God is. A moment later, he's hiding under the trees, as if Hashem can't see him. What a pathetic image. But there's one worse than that. And that is when Hashem arrives in the garden, there's a rule that God only deals with you the way you deal. That's called Hashem Tzilchal Yad Yemineach. Hashem is your shadow at your right hand. A shadow moves exactly as you move. He only deals the way you deal. You move close to him, he comes close to you. You take a step back, you want to see an atheistic option, he presents an atheistic image. That's how. And therefore, man hides under the trees as if he can't be seen, and Hashem arrives in the garden and says, Ayeka, where are you? Where are you? I can't see. And when man crawls out from under the trees and he says, here I am, Hashem says to him, Hamina ate? Did you eat? I don't know. In other words, your interaction with Hashem, the way he interacts with you, is exactly the way you interact with him. So that when man enters the mode of confusion, Hashem operates in a mode of confusion. I mean, Tzolok as a whole, this is not a time to go into it now, but just as a complete aside for some further thought, when Hashem says to him, Hamin ha'etz, did you eat from the fruit of the tree? The word Hamin is Haman. Haman is the leader of Amalek, which is the nation that is the atheistic nation. Doubt. What? God. Maybe there was, maybe there wasn't, maybe there is, maybe there isn't. The Jewish people are the testimony that Hashem's presence is in the world, and the arch enemy fight to the death is the nation of Amalek, and Amalek is Gematria Sophic. Amalek, the numerical equivalent of that word, is doubt. They're the people who bring the dimension of doubt to the world. And of course, they're born when man eats from the fruit of the tree, right? That introduces doubt into the world. And from then on, it becomes a confusion. You see it everywhere. Before that, food, for example. Food. Food was pure. Before the sin, man ate food that was completely absorbed, and there was no excretion. There was no good and bad that needed to be sorted out. When the Jewish people reached the level of Adam, before the sin, traveling through the desert, they ate manna. Manna was a food that was absorbed completely with no excretion. There's no separation of good and bad. There's only the good, and you're sustained by the good. The manna, the man was so elevated, it was called man. Man means what is it? It was so high spiritually, you couldn't even say what it was. The Ramban says the man was crystallized Shekhinah. It was Hashem's presence crystallized, and that's what they were eating. When you eat food like that, there's no excretion. Excretion is a very problematic thing, very humiliating. To be a being who walks around with spiritual thoughts and ideas and relating to Hashem, and within the body there's the offensive excrement. The process of eating means absorbing that which is necessary and revealing the rest as tremendously offensive. But that living at a high enough spiritual level, there's no process like that. But after eating the fruit of the tree, it becomes a problem where the good and the bad are mashed. They can't be discerned anymore. And now the work becomes a very painful work of trying to sort those two out. When the Jews move through the desert, they reach a situation of purity. They're eating food that is manna. It's absorbed completely. There's no excretion. They come face to face with an idolatrous nation who worships excretion. You know that through their travels through the desert, they met a nation called Peor. Peor means to make yourself disgusting, and their cult was the worship of excretion. And we're talking about incredibly intelligent people. We're not talking about weirdos and kinks. The Torah doesn't descend to that. The Torah is talking about people on an unbelievable level. These people worship excretion. They had effigies and idols which represented certain powers in the world, and the way you served that thing was you performed your personal ablutions. The Gemara says there was one woman who had served every idolatry in the world. You can imagine what she'd been through. Okay? So they were all tremendously licentious and illicit. Can you imagine? When she came upon this one, she was so disgusted by it, she decided to show them what she felt. So instead of performing her own bodily functions in front of the idol like they did, she went and did what she had to do on the head of this idol. And the Midrashim said the priests of the idol were so impressed, they said to her, Shkech, they said, we've never seen such consummate worship. What's going on? What's going on is the battle for the human soul, is the battle to separate the good from the bad, to extract, to see truth and leave the alternative as false, from a world that presents a mixed option. The world only presents mixed options. There's no good in the world that doesn't have some bad in it. There's no good in the world that doesn't have a price to pay. And there's no bad in the world that you couldn't possibly relate to with pleasure in some positive fashion. No matter how distorted you have to be, but you could do it. The values of good and evil today do not speak to us like true and false. We're not on a level where we see the good as right and true, and evil as completely false, as ridiculous as 1 and 1 is 3. We don't see it that way. We see it as something worth considering. Maybe a little bit, maybe just a taste. Maybe I'll get away with it. Maybe more, maybe less. Maybe today, maybe not tomorrow. What drives all of this? And the answer is fantasy. That's called dimion. Dimion is the human faculty. All man had to go wrong with initially was the power of imagination. Dimion means there's a famous statement of Yisrael Salanter, the very famous Igeres HaMusa, right? He says, "Adam chafshi b'dimyonoi v'asur b'muskaloi." I don't have the Hebrew here, but I think that's his language. Here, the translation is, man is free in his imagination and bound in his intellect. Chafshi b'dimyonoi, that means in the imagination you're completely free. And the intellect is bound. What he means is that the truth is always bound. The truth is always limited. Truth is always limited. Falsehood is completely limitless. How many right answers are there to a mathematical problem? One. How many wrong answers? Many as you like. Falsehood, the world of illusion and fantasy, is always completely limited. In a dream, you can, anything's possible. In the world of illusion, you can be in two places at once. You can paradoxical opposites are no problem in the world of illusion. In the world of the real, things are limited. By the way, there are many practical applications of this. This is one of the reasons why in Jewish education we fussy about a disciplined upbringing for children. We fussy about a disciplined structure. It isn't only good for behavior, it's good for intellect. A person, a powerful thinker, is a person who can think very creatively, in a very unorthodox fashion, who knows how to break all the rules, but always in paths that are true. And that's always limited paths. The paths that are true are always limited. The paths that are untrue are as many as you want. And therefore, Yisrael's teaching us, he says, Adam chafshi b'dimyoni, a person is free in his imagination. That means free, go whatever you want. Complete divorce from reality. No problem. But in intellect, you are bound. You're bound by the truth. Of course, you need a harmonized coexistence between the two. The correct relationship between Seichel and Dimion, these are partners in the mind. The Seichel is the process of intellect. The Dimion is the process of imagination. And we can never exist one without the other. You can never function in intellect without imagination. Imagination, image. You can never think through a process without images. You can't. But going from step one in a problem to step two requires an image. The image might be the people involved in the problem, the circumstances. If it's mathematics, it'll be numbers. If it's higher mathematics, it'll be symbols. But there's got to be some imaged element. The balance depends on what you're doing. If you're a mathematician, the dominant force is the intellect, and the very ethereal, minimal element is the imagination. If you're a great artist, then the dominant force is the imagination, and the intellect and the logical process is, but it has to be there. A great work of art, it can be a very powerful horse with a very small rider, but the rider has to direct him. A power of imagination without any logical direction is just a mess. There must be a unifying theme that controls it and moves it. And the human problem is that all the energy comes from the imagination. It never comes from intellect. It's very easy to demonstrate. Sit back in an easy chair, relax, take a deep breath, unwind. And what faculty functions? Never intellect, only imagination. Only imagination. And the way the imagination functions is one image to another. And the process is a process of association. When you sit and relax without trying to think about something in a focused fashion, what happens is you get an image, and that triggers a memory, and you smell what it was like, and that takes you someplace else. And before you know it, you can't even remember where you came from. It usually happens when you're trying to daven a good Shemoneh Esrei. You know, you're going to now, You take three steps back. Now you're going to really concentrate. Okay, now you address God with all your intention, and before you know it, you're taking three steps back, and you've been in Hong Kong, or who knows where you've been. If you could concentrate on one thing for 1 minute, you're a Superman, Superwoman. Try to sit and concentrate on one thing for 1 minute. It's very humiliating. Now the Rambam rules that when you're davening Shemoneh Esrei, praying the Amidah, which has 19 blessings, you're only required to have intention for the first one. You know that? That means if your concentration wandered and you realize that actually you were dreaming, you don't have to repeat it as long as you meant the first blessing. And then he goes on to say, and even if you lost concentration in the first one, we don't repeat it because you'll get it wrong again. Very humiliating. 19 blessings, speaking to God. Yeah. And all you can manage is a little bit of focus in the first one. It's already very good. The reason is all the power and the drive is not in the intellect. Intellect always needs to be driven from the outside and controlled. Controlled. Even when you take step one and step two in a problem, and you call up the images that you need, you're much more likely to be snapped out of the train of thought by an association than remain in it. It takes tremendous control to allow the intellect to dominate the process. Bring up an image, only the one you need. Connect it to the next step, discard that, bring up the next image, only the one you need. Very difficult. Very difficult. The intellect has no power of its own. It requires constantly to be held in focus and driven one step to another. The imagination works with no effort at all. And of course it works without intellect. The process is association completely logical. Completely logical. Sometimes you sit down to solve a problem, a very important problem. And if you say this hasn't happened to you, you're lying. A very important problem. You sit down and you focus and you take step one and step two, and suddenly you discover you're someplace far off and you can't even remember what the problem was that you sat down to. Very embarrassing. The big enemy, the original enemy, is the power of fantasy. It's the power of illusion. It's the attraction to enter an unreal world. When a teenager has their first cigarette, the attraction is the world of unreality. And there may be many barriers. It may be distant from you. And the first engagement of it may be painful and nauseating. But there's a world of unreality that beckons. It's a serpent at a distance saying, "Would you like to try this?" Why would I want to do that? Well, let me paint you a picture. And that's what we do to ourselves. That's the great enemy. And therefore, all he had was true and false. And the only alternative was a fantasy world. And he chose to take the clarity of true and false and bring it down to a world of good and evil, which is a world in which the evil can present itself in the fantasy, in the guise of the good. And it does. And therefore, that's the problem. That's the problem. A man sees what he wants to see and disregards the rest. Some great Jewish singer said that. The spies went into Israel. You know, the way the spies went into Israel, and the Jewish people accepted a negative report and they cried. And the book of Eicha that describes that, the book of Lamentations, which is the result of the weeping, the book of Eicha is written, look at the chapters, you'll see that they're alphabetical. A number of the chapters of the book of Eicha, the book of weeping and lamentation, right, which is set into motion by that misperception of what Israel is written alphabetically. But there's two letters out of order. Right? The Pei and Ayin are put out of order. Instead of being Ayin Pei, which means in Hebrew, those two letters are letters, but they're also parts of the body. Ayin is the eye, and the pair is the mouth. Those are reversed. So the Midrash says the mistake the spies made was they put their mouths before their eyes. In other words, an expression of opinion before seeing genuine objectivity. Expression of opinion according to the fantasy, according to the way you want to see it. After that, you'll only see it the way you want to see it. You see what you want to see. You know, they went into the land of Israel. They saw tremendous negative. People were dying all over the place. People were dying. It was a time of tremendous funerals. So they came and they told the Jewish people, this is a land that eats its inhabitants. People die there. The correct vision was that Hashem, God, caused many funerals to be taking place so that they would be undiscovered. People would be involved in their mourning, and these spies could move freely. But they didn't see it that way. They saw it as the land. Once there's a perception, the projection is always the way you want to see that perception. And from then, you know what the correction was? The spies saw it wrongly. So Hashem gave them the mitzvah of tzitzis. Right? Tzitzis was a correction. Because it says you look at the tzitzis and you remember all the mitzvahs of Hashem. By the way, tzitz means to look. Tzitz means to peek at and see. Yeah? The Kabbalistic meaning of tzitzis is that it goes onto a corner. You know, you put them on the corners. Only a cornered garment has them. The meaning of a corner is a distortion. The meaning of a corner is when you have a straight line and it bends, then you get lost. When you're walking along a straight road, you can never get lost. No matter how long the road is, you turn back, you will always see the point of origin. You can never get confused. Once the road turns, then you're in trouble. Because once you've taken the turn, and you turn to look back where you came from, all you see is a lonely, meaningless fork in a meaningless road. Unless you know how to see around corners. So when there's a deviation, the tzitzis tells you keep going straight. There was a correction to misperception. That's why the Gemara says, the reason of tzitzis used to have a blue thread. We don't have the blue thread, not going into all the reasons. But the blue thread that should be on the tzitzis, the purpose is, you see the blue thread, it reminds you of the ocean. The ocean reminds you of the sky, and the sky reminds you of Hashem. Meaning, that you look at this thing, and it's a point of focus, and it readjusts your values and puts you on the correct track. The spies went in with misperception. We now have the mitzvah of tzitzis, which is a correction of perception. But it only... You know, once Rav Dessler was giving a shiur to some businessmen. And he was telling them that tzitzis has a blue thread. And the reason for the thread is you look at the blue thread, reminds you of the ocean, reminds you of the sky, reminds you of God. So one of the businessmen said, Rabbi, are you serious? Do you mean because I look at a piece of blue thread, I'm going to think about God? I mean, isn't that a little extreme? My process of association, God tells me, put a blue thread on these. I look at this and go. So Rav Dessler said to him, you know, there's a law that you shouldn't look at women's garments. Yes, you look over the fence and your neighbor's wife is hanging out her washing and her intimate garments are hanging on the line. You shouldn't look at those garments. You understand that? The man said, yeah, you look at those. You've got some illicit thoughts, you know. And Modesta said, really? A few pieces of colored cloth, you're going to start thinking about women? Depends where your head is. That's the answer. If you think about women, it's plenty. If you love sick in a relationship with God, a blue thread is plenty. It depends where your head is. It's not what you see that makes you think. It's what you want to think about that determines what you see. A person in love to the extent that he can't think about anything else. Doesn't need any reminders. Everything's a reminder. A person in abject fear. Everything reminds him of his fear. To be a rustle of a leaf and he's terrified. His enemy. Take two professionals walking down the street in different professions and ask them after that walk what they noticed. Husband and wife walking down the street. Question them. A 5-minute walk, ask them what they saw. Completely different worlds. Completely different worlds. He didn't notice a single thing that she noticed. She didn't notice... You see what you want to see and disregard the rest. The original problem was a problem of the confusion raised by imagination. Man had no innate sense of attraction to sin, but he had an intellect, he had a mind, and his mind could set up the falsehood of illusion, and that becomes a whole world, and it becomes so powerful that it'll go through the nauseating experience of the cigarette and another one to until those spider threads have become steel cables. Recently somebody said to me, but sometimes there is an innate attraction. There's a young man is attraction for women, for a woman, let's say. So what do you mean it's a spider threat? That's not what's meant. The attraction for women is a good thing. It motivates marriage. That's not a problem. But when he looks across the fence and he sees that woman who's married to that individual, and it has to be her, then there's a distortion. That's only a world of fantasy. The natural innate attraction is a positive thing. Just like any appetite, it's a positive thing. It's completely necessary. But when it could be this food or that food, and it has to be the illicit one or the forbidden one, why? Because it's forbidden. That's why it's called Maim Gnuvim Yimtaku. Stolen waters are sweet. It's because they're stolen that they're sweet. It's very interesting the way the Chazal put it. Stolen waters are sweet. Water's tasteless. It's not like a tasty thing. Water's tasteless, but when it's stolen, it's sweet. That's where the fantasy is. That's where the illusion is. And people, of course, will destroy their lives for an attachment to the illusion. The first objective in Torah study is to become objective. The first objective is to have an organized and disciplined mind and to see things as they are. First of all, in the self, and then projected into reality. And the tools are a brutal and ruthless work on the self to see things as they are and to have a ready. One needs a teacher. Somebody who's more objective and more developed and more mature, who's not afraid to tell you the objective truth about yourself, even though it may hurt. Because it's worth anything to break through those bonds of illusion. Of course, people don't like that. They want a Rebbe who's going to tell them the same fantasy that they see themselves. But anybody with any sense chooses a teacher who's going to be brutal. In the old yeshiva world, they used to look for masters who would be very brutal. Would you go to a martial arts teacher who tells you that you're wonderful? It may cost your life. You want to go to a martial arts teacher who breaks your jaw. Well, then you'll learn to defend yourself. And that's what you want. You want a teacher who's going to expose you to your own objective issues. That's the first goal of an advisor or a teacher or a mentor, is to show you objective reality beyond your illusion. And therefore, that is what we, that's what we began to look at this evening. It's the original problem. Vatera Isha, she saw the tree, and there was a fantasy. Would you like to taste this? There was no innate attraction. It was a mere spider's thread. Once you've tasted it, then it becomes, then those thicken up to become steel cables.
How do you beat the steel cables, Rabbi? How do you overcome the steel cables? Once they become steel cables?
You're in trouble once they become. Once you're locked in with those steel cables, you're in trouble. You've got to unwind them. Then it's a process of tshuva, it's a process of detoxification, and you've got to go into rehab.
But Adam and Eve only saw the true and the false before they ate from the tree, and which would make all distorted.
That's right.
And how would Eve even think about eating from the tree?
All there was a serpent presenting it to her. There was an external illusion. That was, yeah, you never saw those?
But she knows it's false. She knows that all she knows is what's true and what's false.
My patient knew that this cigarette was going to mean his leg being cut off. Knew that clearly. And I wasn't confused about that at all. But he said, one was not going to make any difference. And as soon as he's done it, can't believe it, did it again. How many smokers haven't I seen wake up and cough a pool of blood on the floor and say, I must start smoking filters? Who, what? That's the point. There was no addiction. It starts off as a spider's thread. The Gemara says, in the next world, the righteous people will see what they overcame, their own innate evil, and look like a mountain, and they'll weep. The wicked will see what their own innate attraction, and it was a mere spider's thread, just a thread, and they'll weep. That's what I failed to overcome. The meaning is the righteous will see this mountain that they overcame, because had they given in to that thread, it builds and builds and builds. The wicked person who's had that mountain to climb will be shown that it was nothing had you not built it yourself and built the fantasy into reality and followed that illusion and hadn't maintained the dominance of intellect over imagination. Anyway, that's the first element of Torah growth, is to put the eye before the mouth, as it were. Not the eye before the pay. That is to, first of all, gain a dispassionate, objective reading of a situation, of oneself, of the situation, one's interaction with it. Right? In English, you could call it common sense. It's simply an attachment to reality as it is. Nothing moves without that. But if one begins with the world of fantasy and illusion, there's no limit to what might happen. Okay, stop.